subsequent to that, which deals with these issues, i.e. the fact that you are going to classification crimes, and that there are a number of problems, things like this, and it covers the range.
Yeah. See, the one problem with just using precisely the governor's bill, it was drafted on the idea that we had the existing law. It wasn't drafted on the basis that you had a revised code.
Well,
the revised version is, right. Is what you're saying. Mr. Carpenter?
Oh, I was just asking on the presumptive sentence of 9 years and 50% up or down, you can only move up or down again on the basis of these presumably enumerated mitigating factors and aggravating factors.
Meeting the burden of proof,
convincing evidence. And it's just the factors that are listed in the bill. And if you argue that a factor should be considered that is not listed, at least I believe in the governor's bill and in this, the only way you could get it considered is by going to a three-judge panel. So the factors are specifically set out, only those factors may be considered.
And the way that works is the judge has to find that. I mean, you would argue that to the judge, so if there's something the legislature didn't think of or something extraordinary, the judge would have to agree, yes, this is something extraordinary, and he makes the decision to forward it to the three-judge
panel. Right, he would not send it.
Well, I had one question on that, and we're not back to your original question, just a second while I'm on that. If there is no mitigating or aggravated conditions filed, is the judge have to give the presumptive sentence?
Yes. It's argued it. That's correct.
See, I think we need to keep in mind is when you set out with presumptive sentences, the purpose for all this is to knock out the disparity in sentencing around the state. And you can't do that without restricting some of the leeway of the judge with this thing here. You know, you're all going to might as well just throw the thing out and leave it up to the judge. That's just confusing. But this other one is pretty fancy. You can. And I think probably the record should show. I think the commission probably did a heck of a job and did a lot of work on this. But really, the other one, I think he's going to come closer to getting the unanimous approval of the committee and certainly the public.
I think except for this section on the actual numbered sentences and the range they came up with, all the earlier sections with regard to treatment and sentencing, I think are pretty good. Suspended imposition sentence, probation, parole, all of those things are very good. So what I would want to be grafted in, and I noticed the language from my bill is the predecessor language, and my bill was the old bill of the ninth legislature that came out of the gentleman I've indicated with the ghostwriting I've indicated. That it's you know, that's what we're talking about. And is it our understanding that Mr. Hickey would basically give us a view of something like 297 that would fit the updated current code?
What will happen will be a proposed committee substitute that would mesh with the existing 661.
I'd like to, and also
for all of the lines that 297 does.
I would still like Mr. Stern's version of a proposed CS that plugs that in this 3 or 4.
Well, I think you want to wait and see.
Yeah. You see, the thing is, here's
have it in your head, if not on paper.
I think, all right, we brought up the question of the ranges, and we've got a reading on that, and the fact about having aggravated and mitigating circumstances enumerated in the statute. Was there something else?
Yeah, the issue is, do you apply presumptives to first? Now in the bill, in the governor's bill, presumptives were applied to the first A's. We know that. There were presumptive sentences for first A's. We don't know what would have been done for B's and C's. And the question is, do we ever apply presumptive sentencing to the first offenses?
Yeah. That was the part of the governor's bill.
You said it didn't or
it
did?
They had it applying to first bonds. I don't agree.
Oh, I do. So I'd like to see at least that one way.
Well, that's a pretty simple thing to do, one way or the other.
Whichever way the policy decision goes, the language
draft.
Well, it's not exactly true. It really isn't, because if you have presumptive sentencing for second and third and not for first, you've got problems with drafting that are a little bit more complicated than you might suspect. And you have to deal with problems like on an A felony, the commission came up with 0 to 15 for first offense. But for second offense, presumptive, it was 7 to 11. So what do you do when the judge sentences a first offense B A felon to 15 years? You've got problems. So you've got to deal with those. It's not just a matter of plugging in numbers.
What is the problem, though? I mean, the problem really comes when he's being sentenced for the second offense and he was sentenced 15 years the first time,
no,
and the judge only gives him 7
years. Mr. Chairman, I think I interpose a suggested answer if I'm reading your hand off all right. But the problem is what happens when the guy's been sentenced to 14 years and he brings a sentence appeal in the Supreme Court and says this is obviously clearly erroneous or whatever. in part because look what I would have gotten if I'd been a second offense offender. Mm-hmm. And I read you there, but we can... If we could write the malpractice bill, we can solve that.
You can deal with it. Yeah, but it's not just a matter of...
Yeah, but why allow that to happen? You know, why direct a sentencing scheme that you could allow that to happen? In other words, maybe make a rational, maybe make this lower, require, you know, say two to eight, say, here. And then say, you could go higher, but you gotta go through a three-judge panel if you want to go higher.
See that there's
or you go lower.
That's what the commission dealt with. They just said, well, even though the guy's a first offender, sometimes there's some really bad first offenders, you know, that come along, and and everybody could think up actual cases of it, and the statistics reflected that there was a few cases. So you had to leave some way to give a mechanism to get a high sentence in
the first offense. The problem there is that without presumptive sentencing on the first offense, you don't have to go to the aggravating and proving by clear and convincing evidence aggravating and mitigating factors, whereas you would on second and third. So that's another problem.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Lisa?
Well, since I'm totally unknowledgeable in this field, I'll leave the more angel spirit trip. Why couldn't you, if we're going to go for a fixed number of years rather than a range in the second and third offenses, then you could make the first offense zero up to the number where the second offense begins. It's going to be 7 years, you put it 0 to 7 in the first offense. Second offense is 7. But you also write in that you can mitigate or aggravate on the first offense. In other words, the judge could set 7 years for the first offense, could, and if there are aggravating circumstances, could increase it beyond that.
Well, a presumptive sentence does not necessarily entail sort of prison. You're right. You can do it. You can do a scheme wherein even the presumptive sentence would be a zero, or your low end would be a zero. But you can still embrace the whole presumptive scheme.
I'm just talking about the first offense. If we go for no presumptive.
I don't understand what you're saying.
He's trying to seduce us into putting presumptive sentencing in the first offense.
No, I'm just trying to say that presumptive sentencing for first offenders does not necessarily entail, in other words, your presumptive sentence does not necessarily mean that you have a sentence of it to jail.
Right, your presumptive sentence,
you can have a presumptive sentence of zero.
Or five.
Or you can have a range that goes to zero as your sentence.
Yeah, but I don't see how that gets around the problem with the
Well, it depends on where your ranges are. And you've got unrealistic ranges in here.
Yes, Ms. Cora.
Without doing what Lisa suggests, which then has you getting presumptive treatment into first offenses, I think that the dilemma is not a dilemma if you simply do the following. You can have a section that says, in those cases where the sentencing judge, after considering A, B, C, D, the statutorized Cheney standards, where the sentence is in effect incarceration in excess of what the presumptive sentence for a second or further offense would be, he shall state with particularity his reasons and give some kind of basis in there.
But you still, okay, but the thing is that you still
have... Perhaps give him some formula he must reach, which is slightly above the Cheney standard.
But, okay, then for first offense, he would have, say, discretion from 0 to 9 for an A felony.
He would still have discretion to 15 as long
right,
as
he... Right, he likes to make a specific finding.
And the finding was really justified on the record.
What about the standard of clear and convincing? I think you might come up with equal protection problems here. If a second offense offender is entitled, if he gets sentenced to a aggravated term, to have it proved by clear and convincing evidence, where a first offender doesn't.
Okay, and maybe use that formula for clear and convincing. You can go up to what would be the presumptive sentence for the second offense, just discretion on first offense. Above that, you have perhaps a clear and convincing finding. The judge must make some finding that would get him into that range. Because I agree with the people who say that once in a while there's a first offense that is so bad that you want to be able to get into that higher range. So let's just write a little constitutional provision, carefully taking that into account, with clear and convincing burden of proof, that gets us above that range. Now, and we can do that.
Okay, what I'd like to do is, on this issue, I see that it's not, everybody's not as unanimous as we were on the previous two issues. Let's wait until Mr. Hickey presents his thing, which is going to have a presumptive scheme for first offenders, so everybody can see what a proposal like that would look like. And then we can see if we want to make a policy decision on which direction to go after we've heard, you know, their pitch.
Sure. And, I really would like somebody to try to draft the kind of provision I was talking about.
Well,
I think you're talking about four sentences.
Yeah, well, I'll do that. No,
yeah,
okay.
Just so we have it to look at while Mr. Hickey testifies.
Hey, what you want, Fred, is you want to have an alternative
available that would allow, that would provide for no presumptive sentencing in the first offense, such as there was
0 to 9 here, but you can go to 15. I'm sorry,
0 to 15 there, but you can't go above the presumptive sentence for the second offense unless you meet clear and convincing evidence that the guy is some kind of a rat beyond the standard Cheney standards.
Fine. Okay, and you know one figure you should bear in mind. I think we estimated that this will be 70% of offenders. This will be 30%. That's that for.
Mr. Carpenter, let me add just one quick thought. I think there's two real tendencies to want to be lenient with first offenders, and I'm not going to, I'm not a part of that. I want to be strong with first offenders, because first offenders aren't really first offenders. First offenders are people who have committed first offenses which they have gotten caught and convicted. It could be 100 offenders, you know. And in my experience, we have a tendency to trigger in our minds that this is the first time a person's done something.
Not necessarily.
Right. Here's the other half of the coin, though. What the real argument is for is not leniency. It's our argument for discretion in trying to deal with people. And while what you say may be true, Larry, there's a lot of people that would maybe fall in that classification, although we can't hard to statistically enumerate that. But on the other hand, you have offenses like and murder is the example people always use, and they say, well, there's an example where a lot of people murder people, and it's, you know, it turns out to be one of the ones that you don't have a whole lot of recidivism for, because a lot of people are, it's a crime of, quote, crime of passion.
The ones you can get
husbands shooting wives, and wives shooting husbands, and they aren't really, and so there, some crimes are just kind of strange in that regard. It's not like the guy who's a professional burglar who does get away for a long time and then you catch him. I mean, so that's the other half of the coin. There are problems like that that you end up affecting by saying, this is the sentence.
No, so let's say I was angling for presumptive sentencing on A and B felonies and not C and not misdemeanors. You still have your latitude because of those mitigating and aggravating circumstances. I just want to avoid the tendency that everyone I know has of thinking first offender meaning first time offender ever had anything wrong.
Well, in the eyes of the law, that's true. Mm-hmm. It is a first time offender.
See, we're sitting here, though, and we want to make an exception based upon a condition that may not be true.
But it may be true. We can't make that judgment unless we make it in court.
Well, I don't. So why are we making this different than anything else? I'm saying it just runs both ways.
That's true. Mr. Brown?
Mr. Carpenter may not agree with me, but I think that the idea of assuming that maybe somebody has really committed a crime that, of course, you never convicted him for is a rather dangerous philosophy. And I don't think that that's the basis that our Constitution is written by. And it was that kind of assumption that was used in places like the Court of Star Chamber and a few other nice little places in English history.
All I'm saying is that it runs the other way. That likewise, I don't want you sitting there thinking that because it's a first offense under the law, that we're dealing with someone who has been really cured.
The answer is just some of them are and some of them aren't. The only certainty we have is it's their first conviction for a crime. Whether they've committed other acts which may constitute a crime, some of them might have, and some of them might not. And our legal system, I hope, is designed to protect those people from being prejudged and protect the individual who has never actually committed a crime, who is a genuine first offender. And the thing is, the people on your side of the fence too often, Larry, assume that those people in authority and who make judgments are always either on their side or like God brooding in the sky making a perfect judgment. But what you're doing is you're handing to real imperfect people the power of the state to abuse or not abuse. And you're a freshman now, but you're a pretty bright politician. And the more you got power, the more it easier it is to slide into abusing it. And I don't know what the hell that feels like when you're a commissioner of public safety or head of the FBI for 60 years or something like that. That doesn't say you're bad or good. You know, the tools we're talking about, we're handing over to human beings. We aren't handing over to perfect individuals or God-like creatures that will then always deal justly and fairly.
Do you really have a bright politician?
I knew that was all I was interested in. He didn't hear anything.
I knew he was a bright politician when he said he was just a journalist.
Anyway, let's leave this issue open and not try to decide it today.
Okay, so, Barry, did you want to get any reading on any
Well, yeah, there was, well, I don't need anything else on the imprisonment, but if you feel like doing it, there's one more article in here, and deals with restoration of civil rights after conviction. It would be the final thing in the sentencing material that we would need to look at. I don't think it's necessary to look at the appeal provisions, since that would be affected by whatever scheme we come up with.
Where are we?
That would be on page 38.
What's current law right now, before you get into that? Same subject.
Current law says, there's a statute that says, judgment of imprisonment suspends all civil rights. And it's probably unconstitutional. It's being, too broad. It doesn't suspend it all the time. It only suspends it while you're in jail. And it clearly doesn't suspend all your civil rights.
That's all there is.
Yeah, and there's also another provision, that says that when you're sentenced to life, it results in civil death. Those are the only statutes. What we've done here...
pretty powerful stuff.
Then you're telling me the various bills that have been floating around here the last 4 or 5 years have never made it through on that subject, though.
Apparently, yeah.
We've had some.
Well, what we've done is we try to set out the types of civil rights that are suspended during a period of imprisonment. And page 39, bottom page 38, we find that during the period of imprisonment, only the following civil rights of the defendant are suspended. First is the right to hold public office, trust or profit. Second is the right to serve as a juror. Third is any other civil right, the suspension of which is a reasonable and necessary concomitant of imprisonment. And I'm not sure I know what that word means.
Concomitant, I think, should only have one M.
Where is it?
Oh, I'm sorry, page 39.
Page 39, line 6.
It's concomitant, whatever that is.
Line 6. And made in accordance with regulations adopted by the Department of Health and Social Services. This may go to one of the other questions that we had. There may not be regulations on this. I'm not too sure we could enact that right now. But it's trying to say that you shall only be suspended the civil rights that is necessary as a result of your imprisonment. For example, you don't have the civil right to be liberty, one of them. In certain instances, I guess Harold Lane, or the right to join a union, for example, is a recent case. I'll move on, unless there's... Subsection B says, I believe that's somewhere in existing law, but I didn't write this material, I didn't do the initial research, but it provides that if you've been sentenced, you are not rendered incompetent as a witness in an official proceeding or incapable of acknowledging a sale of conveyance or property. I think those are two types of rights that at one time may have been denied people convicted of crime. Third, in line 14, this is existing law. It is it's in Title 11 in the very beginning. It says that just because you're in prison doesn't mean that people can't commit crimes against you. You could assault someone in prison as well as you could assault someone outside. D is existing law, and I think somewhere else in the code this provision is duplicated, and it says that conviction of a defendant of an offense does not work a forfeiture of property unless the forfeiture is expressly authorized.
What is an example of a situation where the forfeiture is expressly authorized?
Where it is expressly authorized?
What is an example?
Well, I believe in Fish and Game, there's a special forfeiture provision authorizing seizure of the vessel or the aircraft used in illegal hunting. In the drug bill, the old faded drug bill, there's a provision authorizing forfeitures. So that's what we're referring to.
I have never liked that as a matter of principle.
I should also point out at this time, it's important just in terms of because we're talking about forfeitures, when we did our gambling statutes, I neglected, although it was in the commentary, to say that the commission voted on a statute providing for forfeiture of gambling devices and also money used during gambling games. And it never got its way into the draft. That's one of the things. It never got its way into the bill. I just simply didn't do it. It's my mistake. But that will have to be considered when we do markup on gambling. There will be a forfeiture provision for gambling devices and money used in a gambling game that was voted on by the commission.
Sure. Mr. Chairman? Just in passing, my view very strongly felt that the only time there ever should be a forfeiture is when the existence or possession of the thing itself is per se illegal. That is, I got a switchblade knife that is illegal under state and federal law or something like that. But this whole stuff that goes back to the doctrine of Deodan from the time of William I is a bunch of garbage, with all these treasury agents driving around in Cadillacs because the Cadillac was used in conveying heroin across state lines. I mean, to me, that's a bunch of garbage. It's not illegal to own an automobile. Therefore, I don't think there ought to be that kind of a forfeiture.
But there, it's the instrumentality of the crime is thought somehow to be guilty of the crime. And that's where this whole thing came from historically. And it's just a piece of antiquarian interest of claptrap, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, regardless of that.
Subsection
E provided that if once you're discharged from imprisonment inside or outside the state, you're restored to your civil rights. I think it states the obvious, I mean, as a result of our earlier provision. And the inside or outside the state, I have to assume it refers to a situation where the state sends a defendant to Washington to serve time imprisonment. Subsection F provides that upon completion of a sentence other than imprisonment, a defendant is automatically restored any civil rights which were suspended by reason of the conviction unless otherwise expressly provided by law. Now, subsection G and H deal with a situation of employment. Are people who have been convicted of crimes automatically disqualified from employment? And subsection 1 says that a person may not be disqualified from employment in a state agency or a local government agency. Those terms are defined on section I, line 20. Just solely because you have committed a crime, that is not in itself sufficient to justify disqualification from employment. Subsection 2 says, this is in H, it's qualified by saying it must have a substantial relationship to the functions of the employment, and probably we should combine those sections. So you can be disqualified from employment if the offense has a substantial relationship to the functions of the employment.
That's true. Is that in present law provision?
No, it's not. It is not. This is new, and I frankly, at this time, I couldn't tell you where the commission got it from.
I can't.
Is this from personnel regulations?
No. What outfit is Peggy the attorney work for?
Legal aid.
Legal aid. Legal aid. I know. Discussed that with me. They were interested in getting that.
Yeah. And then there's a specific prohibition here. I mean, not a prohibition. A specific exemption, which says that this does not apply to a law enforcement agency. In other words, a law enforcement agency under line 16 could deny employment across the board just because you had been convicted of a crime.
Oh, good Lord. Somebody didn't proofread this. Look at lines 21 and 22. What's going on here? There's no definition of a law enforcement agency, but you've got a definition of a local government agency. Well, is a law enforcement agency the judiciary or is it not?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think you need some definitions in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what is a law enforcement agency?
I think we were talking about the state police. I don't believe we're talking about the courts. I don't think we're talking about...
Well, there are a whole lot of agencies or commissions and things that have enforcement powers. I think it's important.
I'll try to get a definition of that.
Why do we need that statute about all that? I thought we had, you know, discrimination. Don't we have laws enforced somewhere else? Do you have to have that in
well,
code to narrow it down and start picking up?
In the discrimination statute, there's provision dealing with prior offenders or offenders or anything
like that. I think there's a big void in this area of law, if I understand it. Everybody thinks they know what it is, but it's not written down very many places at all, in not in the statute.
You know, you get the problem when you put out an application. Unfortunately, didn't apply for a job for about 21-year span, but when I was back there applying for jobs, it didn't matter. They asked the question, and I know what the applications we put out, have you ever been arrested for a crime? And list the crime and the circumstances, you know. There's nothing wrong with that, is there?
No,
it's
different.
We're just talking about...
This is different. This is not a discrimination statute at all. This simply says you're not disqualified, not necessarily... Well, you're not disqualified because of that. So that I would assume that if you fill out and say, you've been convicted of a crime, then the employer, if he doesn't want to hire you, he's got to find some other reason.
This only applies, though, to state agencies and state permits.
Oh,
it is not dealing with private concerns.
No, it's
not. Mr.
Chairman?
Mr. Brown? It sure is badly written, though. Subsections 2 and 1 and 2, lines 2 and 5 of page 40, seem to contradict each other. In that one case, it says, no person whose civil rights have been restored may solely because of prior conviction be disqualified to engaging in an occupation the state requires a license. So I guess that is different. But what about this rather broad and sweeping thing, no person may be disqualified from employment with a state agency or local government agency solely because of a prior conviction?
It's qualified on H. I believe. It should be. I think age should be part of one. Because
I think maybe the qualifications of age ought to be a little broader, though. Also, I have a sec. I just think that it sounds to me like somebody wrote this other than you, and maybe with the help of you, rewrite some of it and make it internally consistent. And also, to keep saying except as otherwise provided by law, except as otherwise provided by law. Are there other provisions saying that as to convictions for a particular kind of offense, your suspension of your civil rights would go further or for a longer period than set out in this section?
Well, actually, it's an interesting point. You may want to decide for certain offenses that you are, you know, when punishments is that you are disbarred from office or something like that, or you cannot no longer hold employment, you know, with the state or something like that. And I think this allows you to do it.
Is this just speculative?
I think it is.
Somebody might want to write a law that way.
Well, I don't know whether there
is there any.
I could not answer that question. I could not answer that question because I haven't done a search of crimes outside 11. I know there's nothing in the criminal code with that effect.
I suppose we need something on that subject, but this particular section, all of this Article 9, is not the best written article in this bill. Just as a matter of style, even if we agree with the subject.
I really get confused about that because I can think of so many circumstances. It seems like it's almost something that if I was someone after this code is introduced wants to put in a bill to that effect where you get the hearing and you know, find out what all is involved in that. If you throw some new law in like that and that's my, you don't really know. My mind's not working on that, and I can't think of what position would that put.
I'm getting the same impression you are. I'm reading as though there's something left out of this section of this article. I can't think of what it is. Something it's not addressing, but it should be.
There's just so many different crimes and so many different agencies to deal with.
Since you're wondering, right, I mean, basically, it's not get did not get.
No,
dirty.
Don't tell us. Last time we asked you what you wish, you told.
Don't tell us.
I'm doing the sheep or something.
It's awful.
Is there any other questions in section 9? Article 9.
Maybe we need it. We need another draft or something.
That's it.
That's it.
Yeah. This thing I'm not going over is a pillow sentence, and I think it's ridiculous to consider that until you consider what
kind of sentence
what kind of sentence you have.
Okay. Hold on. Next week, we're going to have two big public hearings at 1:30.
1 p.m.
Wednesday. And Thursday, and so a lot of people are flying into town and whatever to testify. And I don't know how, you know, many hours of testimony we're going to have, but this is just a one-time shot. Now, we're not going to have a committee meeting on Monday. We're not going to have one on Friday, so we're just going to be having. On Tuesday, we're going to have Mr. Hickey, regular time at 3 o'clock, present the administration's sentencing proposal. And then we'll just have these two afternoons of public hearings on Wednesday and Thursday, no meeting on Friday either.
Will those go into the evening? I suppose they'll have to.
I think most of the people who are going to testify are going to be pretty specific and say, you know, say what they have to say.
Mr. Chairman, before you you have somebody who's walked in the room that wants to rail against us on something, will you either give an idea to the people sitting in the room, possibly with or without the TV cameras and reporters and all these, what are you communists doing to us, or what are you cop lovers doing to us, to start testifying? Could you give them some kind of an idea of what the consensus of the committee seems to have been? That is, that at least I think it's a consensus of the committee so far that we ought to have a revision, but at least in model, at least, although we have to redraft individual sections in a lot of cases, that the substantive law provisions we're in agreement on, that we have disagreements with ourselves and with the commission on the sentencing provisions. I would just like somebody to know that before they start attacking us for things we didn't do.
Okay.
Well, I think I read right there. I think it is. Maybe the only thing that I'd say, if we're going to do this, I don't see listening to an hour of testimony as to whether we should or should not rewrite the code. You know, you're going to get that negative. Well, I think our law is good way. You know, and I don't know whether that is invaluable time, whether that game, but we've already made a determination to at least do this and put it on the floor. You know, if we could listen to a lot of people come down and just be against the new criminal code and waste hours of testimony. Yeah.
You know, there's always this problem of kind of telling people how to testify, you know, and I think, you know, that most of the people I know who contacted us intend to
have specific comments about specific sections. As far as I know,
it's just kind of like me putting in a bill and everybody comes down here and say whether I should have put the bill in or not. Not testifying on the contents of the bill that's been introduced in the legislature, and there's the bill. If you want to comment on it, fine, you know, whether it's good or bad. But not just a whole, I know some will come down and say, I think it's a month's bill, so you shouldn't rewrite the code. But the bill's already in, and we're talking about the bill itself. And if you can take testimony to that, I think we'll get more knowledge out of it.
Well, I wanted to know that we don't agree among ourselves or with the commission right now on the sentencing provisions, just so they don't, you know, they can testify against the provisions in anybody's particular bill rather than throwing darts at us during the testimony. That
helps. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mr. Carson, are these joint hearings?
Yes, this will be joint hearings. Where? It's going to be in the governor's conference room, and it will be televised, and it will be at 1 p.m. on Wednesday and on Thursday.
Okay, 3 p.m. on Tuesday here as usual.
Right, and then 1 p.m. on Wednesday and Thursday.
You just said 1:30, but you mean 1.
Yeah, 1 o'clock.
There's a room there. Are these witnesses by invitation only, or can somebody show up?
Well, no, we've done this. What we did was I invited everybody in creation I could think of that might have had an interest or some previous involvement through the commission, you know, that testified. We mailed out 200 copies of the bill with a notice of the hearing. These are all people we had in the mailing list during, you know, all over the state. And then we gave out a press release to every newspaper in the state 2 weeks ahead of time, contacted all the legislative information offices.
But a person could fly in and just show up and...
Yeah, I don't think that'll happen too much.
I got a petition today from this woman who called me. It carries a couple of dozen names of people who want that hearing in Fairbanks, and it includes signatures of some attorneys in Fairbanks, like Backstrom and so forth. What do you think about Greg Terry said that when he and Miles are up there on the evening of Friday the 3rd, they could hold a hearing up there?
I'll be out there Friday the 3rd on my own business.
Meeting adjourned 4:35 p.m. January 27th, 1978.
did here was to, I think, give the court a fair amount of flexibility in tailoring the fine to suit the resources of the defendant. For all felonies, it's $10,000, regardless of what class it is, straight across the board, $10,000.
Maximum
$10,000, right. Now, under existing law, I don't believe, in terms of criminal code, is there any fines that approach that level. So we are increasing fines substantially. The question, of course, is $10,000 high enough when you're dealing with a person victim of a felony. When we're dealing with organizations, we're higher fines. For misdemeanors, an A misdemeanor would be a $1,000 maximum fine. B misdemeanor would be a $500 fine. The violation would be $300. Now, if you're dealing with an organization, you have an alternative to fine. Number one, the maximum fine for all offenses committed by an organization is $100,000, clear across the board. Or you could send the organization to an amount not exceeding twice the pecuniary gain realized as a result of the offense. Say you have a crime that involves a property offense committed by the organization, a fraud, you could send the fine to reflect the pecuniary gain via the defense to the organization. So that's a fine structure. Okay. Section 160 said that you are sentenced to pay a fine. The court may grant permission for the payment to be made in a specific period of time or in specified installments, recognizing that some defendants will only be able to pay a fine in installments. And again, when we're talking about fines, the money is going to go straight to the state. When we want to pay off or, you know, compensate the victim, we'll be talking about restitution. But here we're talking about fines and going to the state. And Section 170 discusses the consequences of non-payment. And what it provides is that when a defendant defaults, he has the burden of showing why he shouldn't be imprisoned for non-payment. He must establish by a preponderance of the evidence that his failure wasn't intentional or that he made a good faith effort to obtain the funds. Can't establish that, the court may order his imprisonment until the fine is paid. And on page 28, on lines 3 and 4, a schedule is set out for how long a person can be imprisoned for failure to pay the fine, assuming he has the ability to do so. And the schedule says that it's one day for each $50, and the maximum time would be 6 months that you deserve, whichever is shorter. So if it's a $100 fine, the would have to serve 2 days in jail to pay off due to a potential failure in that state. I thought the victim was rather slow and fine. It doesn't pay for the state to do that, though, because it costs, I don't know, figures, I'm sure it costs over $20 a day, or pretty close to $20 a day to house a person. And if the state is only making $5 a day off the housing, they're losing $15 per day on doing that. But I don't recall how the $50 is doing it. And then it provides that as an organization, the person that's responsible for making disbursements to the asset shall pay it. And failure to do so is punishable under this section. Then subsection B provides that that if it's an excusable default, the court may modify its order of reducing the amount of fine or each installment or even 12 weeks of fine. For example, if the defendant is not able to work anymore to obtain the money to pay the fine, this allows the court to say, okay, we understand that, maybe we should give another sentence. And that would be within the power of the court to say. Section 180 deals with revocation of fine, and and this simply says that the defendant may petition for revocation of the fine, and a failure to do so gives rise to a presumption that his failure to failure to pay was intentional. And and then subsection B says that if a person's conviction is later overthrown and he's paid later reversed, and he's paid a fine to the state, the order overthrown conviction may specify that the money is returned to the defendant if the conviction was unlawful in the first place. Article 6 deals with restitution. And it's important to note again that this is a non-incarcerated alternative. Here we're concerned about compensating the victim for the offense. Now, in existing law, there's only passing reference to restitution as a incentive, and the only mention of it is given in the probation section, and it says that restitution may be authorized to the condition of probation. Now, under the code provision, you can authorize restitution in three circumstances. One is when the person is sentenced to imprisonment, and you're assuming that there will be some form of prison industry established, or in fact, the defendant may have money. And if, under those circumstances, you could send him to imprisonment in order to make restitution to the victim. Secondly, you could put it as a condition of probation. I am sentencing you to 5 years. I'm sentencing 5 years. You shall serve 2, 3 are suspended, and you'll be on probation. One of the conditions is that you make restitution to the victim. Third way you could order restitution is a condition of suspended for this sentence. I am suspending a position of sentence for 5 years in addition if you make restitution to the defendant over a 5 year period of time in the amount of. So we're giving more emphasis here on restitution as a sentencing alternative. But again, you gotta go to jail, you gotta go to jail. And this could be in addition to it, but it can't be substitution for it. Subsection B states, as the fine section stated, that in making an order of restitution, you shall simply take into account the resources of the defendant. Simple language, sometimes a person may simply be unable to work to obtain the money to pay the person, the victim. Now the next section, I think it's called restitution programs, and it's similar to the conditions of probation in the sense that it's supposed to provide the court with examples of restitution programs. And I believe there are four programs that are listed. The first one is paying for the property that has been damaged. I have to admit, after seeing that movie, it's somewhat difficult to get into the sentencing, but I will try. Okay, restitution, there are four programs that are authorized. And again, these are just examples. And we felt that it was necessary to provide some guidance to the court in giving examples. On page 29, line 18, we say that the court may order the person to the defendant to make restitution to the victim for the value of the property taken. Subsection 2, a person medical expenses. Subsection 3, lost wages. Subsection 4 is repairing the damage to the property. And again, both these sections also exclude reimbursement to the victim. So in other words, if you have an insurance loss and if you have property that's stolen and insurance pays for 50 of it, the restitution should be for 50. It's $100. The idea is to make the victim whole. And if you want to impose a fine to the state, for example, you would be allowed to do that, in addition to restitution. So let's consider that. It's under the code for the first offender who is done a property defense, you could fine him $500, and you may also say that he may make restitution for $500 to the victim of the crime. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, if that was, it was felt it would be somewhat difficult to,
I mean, you know, if the guy damages or deals something, X amount of dollars, and all those victims may have, you know, partially recovery on that, the rest of the recovery coming from insurance company, out the money, and this guy's act, society as a whole, suffering for everybody, remember that insurance company, so I'm not a big holder of insurance company. Section again deals with modification of discharge of return to restitution. And the thing is, we have modification of discharge provisions for suspended position sentence, probation, restitution, we don't have to combine. What I think we can do is just simply combine them all into one section and save a couple pages in this rather large bill. Because I believe that the provisions are the same. Saying, number one, the court can modify if it's an unreasonable burden. It could also discharge if it's warranted by the time of the defendant. So, that's restitution. Again, we're trying to give more emphasis to it. Rather than simply say you may order restitution, we're trying to give for some examples of programs for restitution. We're trying to provide for how it can be administered in condition of probation while you're in prison or in condition of suspended sentence. Now, Article 7 deals with community work service. And this could be viewed as restitution to the public. The defendant has right. Okay. And that was, unlike the other provisions, the defendant is required to agree to community work service. And the commission simply felt that without the agreement of the defendant here, that it would be unlikely that he would be a very productive worker. And also, the fact that he doesn't agree to something like this, I think, would probably result in a rather more onerous condition of probation or perhaps the imposition of jail time. I think that I think it's a pretty rational decision. I think that if he doesn't agree to the condition, I think the judge will have a tendency to impose a fairly severe condition of probation, perhaps even a bar jail time. And there's also the constitutional problem with voluntary servitude.
Whatever happens to the case, if the guy is going out and forced him to be in
community work service, again, you authorize them in three ways. One, while you're serving in prison, and secondly, is as a condition of probation. Third, as a condition of NYS. Now, on page 31, line 7, we give examples of community work service. And the important thing here is that the person that you're going to be benefiting is going to be the government. It is not to confer private benefit. In other words, community work service does not entail a situation where you're painting someone's house. It has to be a benefit based on the law of Alaska. Someone may incidentally benefit something, but you're aiming at governmental type things like the schoolhouse or, well, the examples of that, I think, in terms of on public projects designed to reduce or eliminate environmental damage, streams, lakes, ponds, on programs designed to protect the public health, to prevent injury and illness. So you're not talking about ordering someone to paint someone's house. You want to order someone to paint someone's house, you say you're going to provide restitution to this person. We'll go out and hire someone to paint the house, basically. Then subsection B simply says the program community work services is subject to any conditions which the court imposes the employer agrees to, and you don't want to force these people on an unwilling governmental agency, essentially, because there is going to have to be some type of work done in terms of finding liability for, you know, the person on the working compensation. What about an accident occurring while you're paying work service? And then he goes on to say on line 29, page 31, community work service does not confer private benefit upon an individual except as it may be incidental to the public benefit produced by community work service. Again, the public benefit. Well, it's somewhat confusing. I think what it's example. The example that's given in the commentary, which will be available in a few days, says you may order a person at community work service to tutor people. That's going to be somewhat weird because I can't conceive of a situation where we want that person to tutor people. But I'll give you the example. Let's assume I'm arrested for a crime, and one of the conditions is that I go to the, you know, that I go to the public schools of Alaska and I teach people criminal law. And so I'm benefiting those specific people, but it's incidental to the benefit of all that, improving education. It's somewhat funny.
But what's that doing?
Well,
what people are worried about?
Well, trying to, I think. Yeah, the thing is that that's not necessary because you simply say you must be an employer and you define employer as just a government, and then you don't have to worry about who was there, which is probably not necessary.
There might be a lot of non-profit issues.
That's the only verbiage we can say it was.
Well,
yeah. No, okay. It could be called community service.
But I thought
this would be different. I mean, this is authorized to see the judge to say, you shall do this condition of probation even though you're not in jail. But can do it as a condition of imprisonment, so it was possible. Yeah, but it is, I believe, it is, for this kind of effective duty, the judge is saying to correction that this person shall engage in community work service and find an employer that will agree to pay them.
House Judiciary meeting was adjourned at 4:30. Footage number 856.
We have again modification of discharge and same issues there.
House Judiciary Committee meeting, January 27th, 1978.
Thank you.
Ranges, you can take a number that's in the mean of the range and then apply to the extent.
Parker said that within the range, what's the difference between the presumptive sentence and the range of the conviction? Within that range, it's not the claim of the judge. And I presume that the law would be that were a sentence, even within the presumptive range given, that if an appropriate sentence appeal, there would still be the repeat of the change of sentence.
I think you could write that in to the offense appeal, but I think it's drafted now. I believe the judge has the total discretion within that range. As long as, let me give you one example.
You don't think a judge could ever be reversed?
No, the way it's drafted, the only way you have a sentence appeal is you say you did not properly consider factors in aggravation or factors in mitigation. You got to consider all the sections of this sentence proposal. And one of the fundamentals of it in terms of sentence appeal says that you don't really look at the discretion of the mirror so long as you properly consider mitigating aggravated factors. So I read it as giving him utmost discretion within that period, which I really don't concern about.
Yeah. Even if the Supreme Court were to conclude that things like the Cheney standards that are set forth in this law were not considered within that range, it could not reverse a conviction.
Well,
by the state, you could not give an advisory reversal.
The way the sentence appeal statute is written, I don't think the court got jurisdiction on it. I think it would take away jurisdiction on that issue. You know, we only... Okay, well, I'm not sure I'm either. But anyway, I'm just saying that you can't take these numbers applied to a fixed presumptive sentence number as opposed to a range. Now, of course, the problem...
Where did the range come from on the commission?
Okay, the range was simply... We tried a lot of things, and finally, the staff proposal was given to a range, which...
Whose dilemma were you solving? If you don't wait to answer that,
well, the only way I can justify it is simply say that even if you have two rapists in front of you, two robbers in front of you, even though there are no mitigating and aggravating factors that are specifically listed in the statute, the judge should have some leeway to determine that all two robbers are not alike. The circumstances of the crime may be different regardless of whether it was second degree robbery or the situation in the first degree. There are second degree robberies and then there are other second degree robberies. Second offense, the
saying, though, is that you could go to a three-judge panel. I'm sorry, I'm using four numbers. It's 15 here, but it's only 16 here for the second sentence, the aggregate. Now, we do have a mechanism where the judge can say, hey, you deserve more than 16. I'm giving you a three-judge panel. And they can send it to 30. We're saying the judge himself can only go to 15. Factors in the statute. We're rather going to send up. We're going to set up a commission that comprised of five to 34 judges, parole board, and the attorney general, who will propose those factors. Okay, let's get that on board. But anyway, let's forget about that. Let's forget about that issue.
Okay, I'm willing.
Well, I mean, no. Let's go beyond. But the thing is, let's just assume that there are factors. Well, the way it's set up in G is it says that aggravating factors shall increase the presumptive ranges. And then subsection H says mitigating factors shall mitigate the range. There's nothing that lets you consider. The example is if you have one aggravating, you have one mitigating factor, what do you do? One thing that you increase, the other one that you decrease. Now, in the judicial council bill is something that you consider both, given the totality of the circumstance, and then you make a decision. So that's going to have to be done today, because G and H just don't jive.
Let me say one thing about this so far.
Well, you want to list them. You want to list the facts. Yeah. You want to, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The manner done is the other very.
I'm curious on a number of things, actually. Can we? Okay. I'm curious on a number of things.
Can I ask another question? The same answer? I don't know if this is going to send to the committee or not, but I don't like this range.
Well, that's the next issue. Okay, that's the next issue. Is the range idea basically not acceptable? Because if it isn't acceptable, then we know where.